Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to Kudzu Vine. It is May 13th, 2012. I'm your host, David McLaughlin, back and joining me back again. Welcome, Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, and our last week's host and our regular co-host, thank you for all your work last week, Catherine Smith.
Hello, it's great to have you two back. I really appreciate our co-host, our guest host last week, but it's always good to have the family back.
Yeah, great
Thank
job
you.
Doing that. And I think, Catherine, I think you've run the board before, but I will say that I think last week was a first in that either Tim or myself was on the show, and I think that's the first time that one of us has not been on the Kudzu Vine in the 5 years we've been on. But y'all did a great job, thanks to Greg King and Wendy Davis in our absence. But this week, we got some guests. We got the Steve Hour, if you will. We're going to have Steve Stephens of the Left Wing Cracker, a Tennessee political blog. He's going to come on in just a few minutes. And in the second half hour, Steve Oppenheimer, who's running for Georgia Public Service Commission, is going to come on. And then we have all kind of other topics to talk about on this Mother's Day weekend. And first off, we happen to see something on the Washington Post site that lets you pick Mitt Romney's vice presidential candidate. Now, of course, it doesn't just give you a list of names and you pick one. It actually gives you a little algorithm. It gives you some choices. Like the first one, should he take an establishment figure or a Tea Party favorite? Now, depending on which one you choose, you get other choices. We'll just have fun because aren't the Tea Party people, aren't they really more fun to watch, honestly? Would y'all agree?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So you can go safe bet or game changer. And personally, I mean, my goodness, if it's a Tea Party, is it really a safe bet? I mean, you've all seen Palin and Herman Cain and others in action. There's no way they're a safe bet. So I'm going to go game changer. You have historic first or status quo. Well, why don't we just go, you know, status quo and game changer really don't fit, but let's just put it together. And then you have ran for president and never ran. Well, I've seen all these guys that are, and ladies that have run. I want to see something new. I want to see what else I can come up with. And you have served in Senate, served in House. Catherine, what do you think? Should we go to House member or Senate member?
Senate member, because they never win.
Let's go Senate. And then we have a Senate newbie or a seasoned member. Let's say seasoned member. And we get Jim DeMint of South Carolina. I so badly don't want Mitt Romney to win, but if he wins, I would probably pay money to hire better Secret Service workers because I would so trust Mitt Romney than Jim DeMint. But that's the kind of great work you get when you press this thing around. Personally, I'll tell you, I did it several times. I kept wanting to do it to see if I could finally come up with Sarah Palin, but apparently the Washington Post didn't even put her in. I don't know why. She was so much fun last time. Catherine and Tim, y'all both did this too. How did you come up with Catherine when you went through it?
Well, I went through and I picked a Tea Party favorite, a game changer, a historic first, and a woman, and I came up with Nikki Haley.
Okay. A better South Carolinian, in my opinion, than Jim DeMint. But Jim DeMint's just way down my list. Tim, what did you get?
I actually did this twice just to see. And the first time around, I picked an establishment figure, a safe figure, and a career politician, and it spit out Tim Pawlenty. Then I backed up. Pick someone from a battleground state who is a governor with Washington experience, and I ended up with Mitch Daniels. I do find that curious because I really didn't know Indiana's a battleground state this year, but I thought that was two pretty good safe picks and maybe the kind of people that Romney might end up picking.
Yeah, Tim, honestly, that is safe. That's like going to Waffle House and ordering toast.
But don't you think Romney will go safe after what happened in 08?
Well, he might go. He might, you know, he might do like the NFL draft and pull out the Wonderlic test and make sure that his nominee can score over, say, 20. That may be what he does. I just kind of wish they had a category where it said has recorded album, hasn't recorded album. You know who we can hear. Herman Cain. You know, we still got his album in our library, too. Kevin, I'm surprised you didn't play that a time or two when you were running the board since you had control. but, I mean, you're right, Tim, that he may have to go safer than Sarah Palin, but a lot of times when you go through it, I think it seems like there's more than one way you could get to Marco Rubio. Things kind of seem to lean to him and others, so... There's just a lot of directions he can go, and, of course, some of the things that happened this week may impact it, but we'll have to save that for a little later in the show because our first guest, I believe, has already called in from the left-wing cracker, Steve Steffens. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. Well, I noticed that your blog was considered one of the best progressive blogs on Tennessee politics, and it looks from reading it, that you're out of the Memphis-Shelby County area. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I tend to focus on local and state issues more than national because there are plenty of great writers with regards to national politics, and I usually follow what's going on in Memphis-Shelby County, West Tennessee, and what's going on in the legislature these days.
Well, and that's what we need because we're a show that focuses on Southern politics, so since it's like 13, 15 different states, depending on how you count certain border states, we need to get folks to live in those states. So you've been writing the left-wing cracker. How long has this blog been going, and tell us a little about its history and what caused it to get started?
Well, it was in the aftermath of Kerry losing to Bush in November 2004. There was already one really wonderful blog in the state. At the time, it was called South Knox Bubba. It was really the first progressive blog in the state. And a gentleman in Knoxville does a wonderful job. But he shut it down after about a year and a half, much to our shock, but then came back a few months later with the blog Knox Views. Knox Views has a good review of what's going on in East Tennessee, and it's really one of the major left-wing blogs in the state. But and that was what got me to writing. A lot of us really came of age in 2006 when Harold Ford Jr. decided to run for the Senate and his 9th district congressional seat opened up. And it was a very contentious race. The current congressman, Steve Cohen, won with only 32% in that race. He barely defeated a young woman named Nikki Tinker, who was an attorney for Pinnacle Airlines. Well, once Cohen, who'd been in the state Senate for 24 years from Memphis, got in the Congress, he became very popular here. He'd always had popularity in Midtown Memphis, which is where most of the white liberal Democrats reside in the city and county. And a lot of us came of age defending him and championing his 2006 campaign. Of course, I'd known him personally, working with him in local politics for some 30 years. But, you know, over the course of time, there's just now two major blogs in town, mine and Vibink, which happens to be written by my friend Steve Ross, who's decided to take his talents, hopefully, to the county commission. He's running for a vacant seat on the Shelby County Commission. But what's going on here right now is Shelby County, excuse me, is dealing with a situation where we're going to merge the suburban Shelby County school system with the Memphis City system, which caused a lot of havoc. But the legislature, having gone full tilt to the Republican side after the 2010 elections, the Republicans statewide have done their best to assist Shelby County in trying to prevent this. Excuse me. And that's been a source of conflict. Now, to add to that, it appears that they're going to, some of the municipalities have decided that they're going to have referenda to create special school districts, and that's going to coincide with our August primary and general county general election. Tennessee is an odd state in that their county general elections, instead of being held at the same time in November as all the other general elections, are held in August, and the at the same time as the state and federal primaries. And what happens is this creates confusion within the voters, and to be perfectly honest, it makes it hard to create one solid, unified Democratic ticket.
Yeah, and probably also adds to the cost because you're having more than one election. You're having an August level with budgets being tough. You know, a lot of times Democrats and Republicans, at least in Georgia, have agreed at times that we need to hold less elections because it would be a better use of funds. Well, I'm not the only person on the Country Vine tonight, so I want to get around, and we want to talk a lot about different Tennessee races, be it presidential, Senate, congressional, and anything else. Tim, what are some questions you have on Tennessee politics?
Steve, by the way, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And for the benefit of our listeners around the country who have never been to Memphis, is Memphis the typical big city politically? By that I mean strongly Democratic in the city limits, surrounded by more, shall we say, conservative suburbs?
I would think that's an excellent characterization. The city itself is in its northern, southern, and western sections, very liberal Democratic. In its eastern section, more moderated by Republicans, although they're more moderate in the city than they are outside the city limits. Although the irony is the strongest and largest Democratic club in Shelby County, arguably in the state, is the Germantown Democratic Club in a typically Republican suburb. Yet they have 250 members, and its members work very, very hard to raise money and work in on the ground in campaigns for Democrats here.
Okay. And you also mentioned Steve Cohen, whose career we've watched with interest since his election and his popularity. Is he going to draw a strong challenger in the 9th district this year, or any opposition at all?
Well, it's funny that you should mention that. The irony is, while some of us have championed primarying Democrats who aren't as progressive as they should be, Cohen, arguably the most progressive Democrat in the South, in my opinion, has been continually primaried, and usually by African-American candidates coming from the right, which may sound very strange, but there are people in this town who, frankly, would like to see another clone of Harold Ford Jr. Jr. wasn't nearly as popular among some of us as his father, simply because he would vote for things like the bankruptcy bill, which negatively affected a great many of his own constituents. And a lot of us felt like he was throwing his constituents under the bus. This year, the main contender, the main primary challenger to Cohen is Tamika Hart, who was on that school board, the Memphis City School Board, that voted to surrender its charter and merge with Shelby County Schools. Now, a lot of people felt she should have attempted to run for the Unified School Board and see that through, but she decided to challenge Cohen for Congress. Well, she had a great many friends and still does, But when it came time to challenge Cohen, she's been unable to raise money. With Cohen sitting on over $1 million cash on hand, she only has about $20,000 cash on hand. And a few people showed up. Well, the interesting thing is, for one thing, Cohen understands that to be a white congressman in a primarily African-American district, he has to work twice as hard to retain their respect and their loyalty. And he's done that. Each of the last two times he's won his primary, he's done so with over 75% of the African-American vote, and that was against African-American candidates. Had Hart, the general consensus among Democrats here is, had Hart waited perhaps another 4 to 6 years for Cohen to leave office, as I don't think he's going to be in forever. He's in his early 60s now. I just don't think that he's going to be in forever. And she would have been in a very good position had she decided to wait and go to another office. But she left, and unfortunately, there's no real signs that that she's going to have much traction. In fact, I've heard through back channels that when Emily's List, a friend of mine knows some of the people in the Cohen campaign. My understanding is they ran into some people from Emily's List, and they said, "Oh no, we're not going to get involved because you don't have significant opposition." So they don't feel that Hart is enough of a challenger, clearly having only raised about $20,000. Cohen is going to be congressman as long as he wants to. He was upset when, in the redistricting, in order to strengthen the financial resolve of Stephen Fincher in the 8th District, the Republicans took much of East Memphis away from Cohen, and in fact, most of the primarily Jewish areas of the city, instead of being in Cohen's 9th, are now in Stephen Fincher's 8th District. Cohen, once the general comes, will face Dr. George Flynn, who is a radiologist and owner of several radio stations in the city, and the father of Shay Flynn, who is a far more moderate, almost liberal city council member. Dr. Flynn ran in the 8th District 2 years ago, spent a great deal of money, and came in a distant third in the Republican primary. And given that the numbers reflect that, especially in a year where Barack Obama is running for reelection, he may well spend $3 or $4 million, but it's not going to do him any good, and Cohen will, at all probability, be reelected.
All right. Well, on that, let me turn it over to a lady who has a rather progressive congressman of her own, Catherine. Catherine, you with us?
Catherine, let me leave the board real quick.
I'm here. I was on.
Okay.
I was on mute. I'm sorry, I was on mute. I have to challenge your claim that you have the most progressive congressman in the South. Because I got Congressman John Lewis here in the 5th Congressional District in Georgia, and
you know what? I agree with you. I concede completely on that. And I loved what he did the other day, by the way. That was awesome.
About the gay marriage?
Yes, when he basically stared down the Republican congressman. That was just magnificent.
Yeah, he is a stalwart guy. There's no, he's a great guy. And he's also a really great guy. I mean, he's not just a great congressman. He's a great, very energetic campaigner, very, very warm and generous individual. Anyway, well, I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of Memphis. And it's sort of my favorite close by vacation spot.
Wonderful.
I wanted to ask you how things are going for the Obama campaign. Do you see a lot of visibility in Tennessee with OFA or whatever they're calling themselves? I guess they're just calling them the reelect now.
Well, let me tell you what's happened. We've got the West Tennessee Resource Center just opened in Memphis a couple of weeks ago with Congressman Cohen and Memphis Mayor A.C. Wharton opening it up. It's a joint project of the Tennessee Democratic Party and the Shelby County Democratic Party. Meetings are being held every week now for the Obama campaign as well as for the local Shelby County Democratic campaigns. We're starting to see signs, and we're starting to see some action. What we're doing now and what's taking place is, given that Tennessee unfortunately joined the states with draconian voter ID laws, we are working to try at this time to make sure that as many people who would be affected, primarily the elderly and African Americans who move very frequently in this town, make sure that they have their registration and make sure that they have our IDs. And I think there's also going to be a plan in place to make sure that we have watchers in all the polls to ensure that if one of our voters is being challenged, there's going to be a Democratic Party person there to stand up for them and make sure that they are allowed to vote. That's going to be the biggest battle with regards to the Obama campaign. Obama should win in Shelby County this year without much trouble. We're going to do our best to make sure it is as high as possible. Outside Shelby and Davidson counties, I'm not sure that the president's going to do well at all, to be perfectly honest with you. It was one of the things that frankly hurt our local our legislative candidates in 08 was the fact that people who'd been voting Democrat all their lives out in the rural areas unfortunately couldn't bring themselves to vote for president. And then a lot of people just simply didn't bother to go vote in the legislative elections 2 years ago, and that's why the Democrats suffered badly, losing 15 state house seats.
Do you think that that Mitt Romney's choice of vice presidential running mate will have an effect on that? Do you think that, you know, if he picks, you know, whoever he picks, do you think that his choice could help the president or help Romney, or is it just that they don't want to vote for the president?
Well, I think white Democrats outside of the urban areas might be more likely somewhat to vote for the president this year, but to what extent, I frankly just don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of dissatisfaction with the Republicans in the Congress for the simple fact that it doesn't matter what the president proposes, even if it was something that they themselves proposed. If Obama supports it, they're against it.
It's exactly.
It's going to be very, very difficult, and the Republicans are frankly going to tie Obama to every Democratic candidate. You know, in Memphis, in Shelby County and in Davidson County, well, bring it on, because all that's going to do is help Democrats. In the collar counties, not so much.
Well, thank you. I'm going to pass this back to David now. Go ahead, David.
Right.
Okay. You had Steve, you had mentioned Harold Ford and the fact that he was a congressman in Memphis before. Well, in 2006, he had an incredibly tight U.S. Senate race, probably one of the tightest ones in a good year for Democrats that wasn't won by the Democrat. And a lot of that had to do with the controversial ad that was put out. So Bob Corker, of course, goes into serving pretty weak, you would think. Yet now he's up for his first reelection, in which incumbent senators have the toughest time, the first time they face the voters and as an incumbent. And no big-name candidates have stepped up. Or the candidates have stepped up, have not been well-funded like a big name, maybe I should say. And then they actually had a poll that came out that showed that his re-elect numbers were not incredibly impressive. They're right around 50. Why do you believe a bigger candidate hadn't stepped up, or one of the candidates that have stepped up for the Democrats has not been better funded to make this more of a hot race?
Well, part of the problem is this. Having been involved in county and state politics for 30 years, West Tennessee used to run the legislature. The late Governor Ned Ray McWhorter, who is dearly beloved by all Democrats, who just passed away about a year ago, the late Lieutenant Governor John Wilder, and former House Speaker Jimmy Nafee, who was essentially redistricted out and is retiring. They held so much control for so many years, and unfortunately, they really didn't build a bench. Plus, when you consider the fact that the only statewide elections in Tennessee are governor and the two United States Senate races, that makes it very difficult to build any kind of statewide bench. We don't elect an attorney general or lieutenant governor. Lieutenant governor is the Speaker of the Senate. And that really has hindered us in building any kind of a bench. Combine that with the fact that 2 years ago, of the three Democratic Senate seats, Democratic congressional seats outside of Shelby and Davidson counties, the Northwest Tennessee seat held by John Tanner was lost when he didn't run for re-election. The suburban Nashville seat held by Bart Gordon was lost, and incumbent Lincoln Davis was defeated by Scott Desjarlais. That pretty much wiped out the bench. Steve Cohen is really not perceived to have, sadly, that much support outside of Shelby and Davidson counties, and that would be very difficult, and there's no real indication that he would want to go beyond the U.S. House. Jim Cooper has already made one unsuccessful Senate run in 1994 when he lost to Fred Thompson. Right now, the Democratic Party, which depended, frankly, far too much on lobbyists and people like Harold Ford Sr. to have a strong Memphis contingency, they don't have a bench. They're not really organized. This is the first time that the Democrats have truly been out of power so completely in 140 years, and they're still in the wilderness. That's why the primary candidate, whom I'm supporting, is the actress Park Overall. She gave a very strong pro-Democratic speech at the state Jackson Day dinner a couple of months ago, and while among Democratic activists she's very, very popular, unless you remember her from the spinoff of Golden Girls, Empty Nest, you'd be hard-pressed to place her. Now, the problem is because of that, she's unable to raise a great deal of money. I mean, there's still time, and I agree with you, Corker isn't exactly the strongest candidate in the race, but we don't have a bench, and we're trying to rebuild one.
Yeah, you mentioned actress Park Overall. I see your picture on her website, and she's kind of got, I guess, to be like, oh, yeah, I've seen her in something. I would have never, been able to name her name. And then they mentioned the movie she's been in. And you're like, oh, yeah, those are some decent, name movies, Mississippi Burning, Kindergarten Cop, Beer for My Horses. You know, you're like, okay, so, but, you know, it's probably just as good a movie listing as Fred Thompson had. Why has she not got more traction? I mean, like, for instance, if you look at her website, I mean, it's pretty dreadful looking. I mean, that's something that's pretty easy to get going inexpensively. I mean, why more polished, or why have people not given her more polish, if you will?
Well, I mean, she really didn't get in the race until early April. So she's still feeling her way around. She's got, my understanding is she's got a young, energetic, but inexperienced staff. To be perfectly honest, we're not getting much help from Washington. The old power brokers in the state, and a lot of them, frankly, tended to be blue dogs, so they didn't exactly fire up the base outside of Memphis and Nashville. And for another thing, it seems like the Nashville side, and I don't want to poke fingers, but it seems like they don't seem to think that the state exists outside of Nashville, but that may just be my Memphis bias. We have a lot of work to do. We have to build from the ground up. It's not a position anyone here has really been in before. We were really one of the last states, other than Arkansas, to where Democrats lost power. And it is a slow rebuilding process. It's going to take some time. One of the races where we are very hopeful, to be perfectly honest, where we think we have a reasonably good chance at a pickup, is in U.S. House District 4, which was redistricted to include some of suburban Nashville. It's the current congressman is Scott Desjarlais, who is a physician, and the candidate opposing him is State Senator Eric Stewart of Belvedere, who is a moderate Democrat, who's very popular in his district, well-known because his district is fairly close to Chattanooga. He's fairly well-known in southeast and south central Tennessee. We think that he has a fairly good chance. He's running a very, very strong campaign. Primarily, he's the major hope we have for a pickup in the U.S. House. Most of the other seats just simply don't have well-funded challengers. In the 8th Congressional District, where Stephen Fincher has run amok, Fincher has known primarily for feathering his own nest, and be perfectly honest, although even with redistricting, where Shelby County takes up about 35% to 40% of the 8th Congressional District, 60, the rest of it is rural. Yet that didn't stop Fincher from giving up his seat on the House Agriculture Committee to go on the House Ways and Means Committee. Nothing wrong with being on Ways and Means, but that sure doesn't affect someone in Obion or Weakley counties the way it would someone in, say, Germantown or Collierville in eastern Shelby County.
Yeah. Well, I guess you've covered a lot of these different races, but Steve, you're in the state unlike us. What are some things we hadn't asked about this happening in Tennessee politics?
Well, the major thing that we've noticed here is over the last 2 years, since the Republicans gained nearly a 2-to-1 advantage in both houses in the state legislature, they have basically run amok. They passed a guns in bars bill that simply put, the state's bar owners did not want, and have gone to great lengths to try and overturn. You had the Don't Say Gay bill, which fortunately was blocked because the governor made it known that he really didn't want that to come up. The mountaintop removal bills, the Lieutenant Governor Ramsey, who is from extreme northeast Tennessee, basically is in bed with the coal miners, the coal mining companies up there. And he's doing all he can to help them literally rip the tops off mountains to assist in coal mining, and it's destroying so much of the natural beauty of East Tennessee. And unfortunately, because Democrats are outnumbered almost 2-to-1, they've been powerless to stop it. There was one other thing that I wanted to talk about, and it figures it went out of my head. But the main thing of it is that the Republicans, this is the first time they've been in complete control of the legislature for 140 years, and they've essentially acted with all the maturity of high school sophomore boys who just stumbled on to a keg of beer. They have made Tennessee a national laughingstock. The Gateway Sexual Activity Bill, where if two high school students are holding hands, they could be arrested. It's ridiculous. And the fact of the matter is, much of this will be thrown out in court, but it'll force the state to spend money that it can't afford to spend to defend it. that and the fact that while everyone's focusing on what Scott Walker is doing to unions in Wisconsin, Bill Haslam and the Republican legislature has been going at it at the same speed, and no one pays attention. And they're just basically running us over. Our fears are that we could lose a few more seats, and the possibility is that Democrats could be down to 25 out of 99 in the House and 9 or 10 in a 33-seat Senate. We are doing our best to fight in House races. In Shelby County, in effect, the county lost two House seats and a Senate seat, and they made sure that, of course, those seats that were lost were Democratic, despite the fact that Shelby County is overwhelmingly Democratic. It's in court, but I don't expect it to be overturned, unfortunately. So we're fighting at every level we can. We're basically coming at this, like I said, from the ground up.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you for coming on the Cugsy Vine and filling us in on Tennessee politics. Very informative. Had no idea that the numbers in the House would get to almost 1-4, possibly. That's a sad situation, and hopefully
we can get the ballot box
will be better than that.
Well, we hope so. We're doing everything we can. We know we're fighting an uphill battle right now. We need to get the rural areas engaged, but, you know, like rural West Tennessee has lost a lot of jobs, and people have had to move. People have had to leave, and West Tennessee was depopulated, while Middle and East Tennessee were heavily populated, and that's hurt us. It really has hurt us, and we're on the way up. And listen, thank you so much. I've enjoyed this, and feel free to gab me back anytime. I love this.
Yeah, well, as Tennessee races progress, we'll get back with you.
All right, Dave.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Bye-bye. Well, I guess we had Steve Steffens on of the Left Wing Cracker. Very interesting name, almost a self-depreciating name of his blog, but seems to be very passionate about the issues in Tennessee politics. I should have our next guest calling in any minute. I just got a call in. I didn't recognize that may be related to that. If they call back, I'm going to let y'all talk amongst yourselves. I thought it was a Saturday Night Live skit where they said that in the past. But until Steve Oppenheimer calls in, let me go ahead and get us started. The president made a pretty huge announcement. Now, you can say, hey, this was going to be made at some point anyway, or Vice President Biden forced his hand. Nevertheless, the president came out in favor of gay marriage, and not just civil unions, but gay marriage. Tim, how big a deal is this?
I don't really think there is a big upside or downside to this. So I got to believe the president, you know, now believes this. The economy is still going to drive this election, and I don't think that what the vice president did last Sunday was any accident. I think at the behest of the administration, he took it out for a spin before the president did it, but that's just my thoughts on it.
Yes, Catherine, how big a deal is this? And you can talk about the actual stance or the political side of it, any angle you want to go at.
Well, I think it's it was a very emotional the remarks I found to be very emotional and very authentic. I found him to be very sort of uncomfortable talking about this in the past. So I think that this conversation he had with Robin Roberts, he seemed much more comfortable talking about it. So I suspect that he's, you know, he said he's been evolving about this. I suspect that he's been feeling this way for perhaps longer than he's willing to reveal. And it seemed like a very comfortable thing for him to discuss now that he's said what he believes in. As far as the political angle, the people who don't believe in providing
and giving full rights to everyone, we're not, probably never going to vote for the president anyway. So I don't think he loses votes. I think what he does do is gain confidence in people who believe in these rights very strongly, and we're disappointed in him for not coming out earlier about it. So I think, I mean, I think that on the Democratic side, I think it helps him. It certainly is helping his fundraising. He raised, what, like a couple $1 million in 90 minutes after the announcement. And, you know, I have a lot of LGBT friends, and they are all thrilled and very excited about the reelect campaign. So I think it does boost his sort of bona fides in the Democratic community. So I think it's good.
Yes, and on the new Newsweek issue, they are calling him the first gay president.
I guess, yeah, I saw
under
that.
Newsweek rationale, he would now be the second black president, because I guess now Lyndon Johnson's the first black president since just supporting something.
I thought Bill Clinton was the first black president.
Maybe it's Harry Truman, Abraham Lincoln, maybe. I don't know, but I thought that.
I thought they always said it was Clinton.
It's Clinton. Okay, well, their reasoning obviously is pretty strange. Usually you would have to be something to be the first of, not just supportive of somebody. Well, let's go ahead and welcome in our second guest to the program.
I practiced dentistry for more than 20 years, so I have a science background as I come into that. And I was always very involved in the community. And when I retired from my practice, I became more involved in activist and leadership roles with things that I'd simply been volunteering for before. And about the last 10 years, I've been involved in national security and energy issues. And the last 6 years, in particular, I've been focused on energy and energy security as it relates to our dependence and use of oil in transportation and how that impacts our national security, our foreign policy, our economy, and our environment. In the last 3 years, I've been involved in Atlanta, Georgia, working with Clean Cities Atlanta, which is a Department of Energy program that does just that, focuses on reducing dependence on oil. And it's through that that I became involved with other activities with the City of Atlanta and advancement of electric vehicles into the marketplace with various organizations and groups that gotten involved in the broader sustainability community. So that is my background and my pathway into this. At the national level, I'll say I was involved with some interesting organizations from Washington, the Institute for Analysis of Global Security, and the Set America Free Coalition that actually worked on energy issues in a bipartisan or really a nonpartisan fashion to really envision where the country needed to go and work to move forward to that goal.
Yes. Well, I tell you what, I do have a few more questions, but I'm going to pass it around to some issues-based questions or other things first. Tim, Catherine, and then I'll come back. If they hadn't asked what I'm thinking of, I'm going to come back at you. Tim, some questions for Steve Oppenheimer.
Yes, sir. Historically speaking, races for the Public Service Commission are quite often overshadowed by other races on the ballot in this state. Have you found that to be true in your campaigning this year?
Absolutely. I mean, that is very true. And this is a race that people don't even necessarily recognize the name of the position, but the Public Service Commission is a board constituted of five commissioners. This year, two of those seats are in play. And this really impacts every single Georgia resident and business, because it is this board that works with the utility to review both rate requests and what is equally important is a what they call an integrated resource plan, or a plan of how future need is going to be met. So electricity is a big piece of what the commission does. They also do oversee telecommunications, transportation, generally in the tourism industry, and natural gas services. And
okay,
it is true.
And it is true, It always has been in this state, and public service commission races for some reason. Even when one party...
The answer lies in having a diversification of what our sources are. And for some time in Georgia, that's going to include coal. We've got nuclear. We've got hydro. And we've got biomass. But on the horizon, and really being... seeing implementation in the field now are some larger solar projects that the integration of solar into the mix has particular viability with the decrease in the cost of the panels and also the predictability of what the fuel cost is going to be in the future. You know what the sun shining is going to cost you in the future. Something people don't necessarily think of as an alternate alternative form of energy, but things that we should consider as ways of meeting need are energy efficiency, because if we are more efficient, if we can get more done with the same amount of power produced at a plant, because the end user is using appliances that are more efficient, or they're smarter and can decide when they want to run, whether they're at peak time or non-peak time, without actually generating any additional power at the power plant, the same amount or more need can be met by consumers and businesses.
Well, thank you for that very informative answer. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Catherine. Catherine, you with us?
I had myself on mute again. I'm sorry. I keep doing that, and then I forget. Thanks for being on tonight, Steve. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you again. We actually met up in Hiawassee at the Young Democrats Convention. I wanted to ask you about energy efficiency. I've long believed that it is in the best interest of, well, let's just say it because they're the biggest provider in Southern Company, Georgia Power's. It's been in their best interest for us to continue to use power at a faster rate because it increases their sales, so to speak, and then satisfies their stockholders. And I actually did speak in front of the Public Service Commission about this several years ago, that I wonder about, you know, how does Georgia Power accept and encourage energy efficiency while maintaining their good relationship with their shareholders and growing their business?
I'm going to backtrack into the original question about why we don't hear much about the Public Service Commission, and that is there's not much public about it, and there hasn't been a lot of public service in it, particularly in the last 4 years since the Consumer Utility Council, which served as an advocate for the residential ratepayers in utility cases, disappeared in 2008. But now back to the thing about energy efficiency. Last year, Georgia Power did receive expert testimony and did decide they're going to start incorporating energy efficiency benchmarks in their integrated resource plan. Now, how they're ultimately rewarded for it happens in a couple different ways. Their energy efficiency is its own business, and Georgia Power is in that business as well as the energy production business. So that is a space. It's a space in the business world where people are coming into office buildings, industrial plants, and selling energy efficiency services on the user end because it has value to the user. So it's still something that can remain a revenue stream for the utility aside from just selling kilowatts or just selling the electricity itself. But in some states where there are renewable portfolio standards, where the state has a benchmark goal by a benchmark date to achieve a certain amount of the total production, it might be 10%, it might be 20% by a certain date, a lot of times the utilities compensation can be that they're rewarded on how well they serve that customer's needs and how well they control the growth of that customer's bills. And in some of those states, you will find that if we compare only the price per kilowatt hour to the price in Georgia, the price per kilowatt hour might be a little bit more. However, the same size home doesn't cost, the bill to service that same size home because it's more efficient doesn't cost more. So the company gets compensated for the efficiency piece, and they still get compensated for the energy piece. But as you shift the compensation towards the efficiency, along with that comes a lot of environmental benefits of not needing to produce as much energy and all the fossil fuels. With respect to any of the fossil fuels, that would mean reducing the amount of water that's necessary for electricity production. So there's a lot of societal and health benefits that come along with less energy production.
Oh, absolutely. I totally understand that. Well, that's a very interesting. I'm glad to hear that there's some, you know, sort of balance that we can try to achieve. I have another question that is a question that really sort of drives me crazy sometimes, and maybe you can clarify this for me. It's a little bit off the Public Service Commission, but seems to be related to some of the things that you talked about when you were introducing yourself. We hear a lot about this, you know, relying on American oil and, you know, the pipeline that they wanted to build from Canada down to the Gulf. But it's my understanding that when we pump oil out of anywhere in the United States, and anywhere, actually, anywhere, that it basically goes to the highest bidder. So just because we're pumping oil in the United States doesn't mean that the United States is going to be using that oil. Is that correct?
It's absolutely correct. The number one export from the United States last year was refined oil products, which is pretty remarkable. And it approximated how much oil we imported. But oil is a global market. So wherever you're
right.
producing oil, you can put it in a barrel, you can ship it somewhere else, and right now it's worth $100-ish a barrel. And there was a time where the demand was more static, that you'd say, okay, the more America and the free world produces oil, the less the OPEC countries would produce, which was true. Now you've got such growth in the emerging economies in China and India and Malaysia that the world, you know, that they still are not going to overproduce oil, where the price per barrel is going to fall below where the people who control most of the oil want it to be. But oil is a global market, and we've come such a long way in humankind that we live in a global world. So if we produced enough American oil, refined enough American oil, and only worried about America, what would happen to all the democracies that are our partners and our allies in the world don't happen to be resource-rich like we are? What happens to them? What happens to their democracies?
Right. And you know, it's the only way I see it helping our dependence on other oil is if we nationalized the oil and said, okay, all the oil that we have is our oil and we can decide who to sell it to. But that's never going to happen. It's going to be Shell or Exxon or whoever that,
I'll give you I'd take a different tack on that. And I wouldn't go in that direction, because as we were talking about electricity and we said we wanted a diversification of energy sources, the same holds true in transportation. And we have tremendous resources now of natural gas in America. And those natural gas opens up a lot of opportunities for heavy vehicles to be running on natural gas, eventually lighter, medium-duty vehicles, and maybe even ultimately lighter-duty vehicles running on natural gas. It's happening in other places in the world. But
I'm not suggesting nationalizing the oil. I'm just saying that it seems to me that that's the only way because that seems to be a right wing common question or comment is that, you know, if we just, you know, got the oil from the U.S., then we would be all set. But that's not the way it works, because it goes wherever it goes. It doesn't come to us. It goes to the international oil companies, and they distribute it however they distribute it. So thank you for elaborating on that. I think I've taken up way more time than I was supposed to, so I'm going to pass it back to David. Thank you.
We're okay. We wanted to give Steve plenty of time on the Kudzu Vine Light. But Steve, one final question, since you're a candidate. If somebody's heard you tonight and likes what they hear and want to support your campaign, what are some ways they can do that?
They can go to steveforgeorgia.com, and there's more information there about me, the campaign, the issues, and how are we on time? Do I have a minute to say a couple things?
Well, say a couple things.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just think 2013 is a very critical year, and it's a year that the Public Service Commission race should get some bandwidth. During the last 5.5 years, there's been a cumulative increase in the base rate for electric residential users of $5.6 billion. And a part of that is due to the fact that that Consumer Utility Council that used to represent the residential users went away. And if I get to the commission, I will be the watchdog to make sure that the regular Georgians' interest is weighed alongside the utility company's interest. And I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a both and everybody can win. We've got a very good utility company here that does a good job at what they do. They have smart people. And if we can agree what's good for Georgia and Georgians and what's good for the company and find the alignment of interest and redirect the ship a little, I think both can succeed. And that's what we have to do, because 2013 is crucial, because that's the year when they're going to reevaluate the integrated resource plan. Are we going to have more dependence on energy efficiency? Are we going to have a shoot for higher usage of alternative energy? Are we going to be reducing coal use? Are we going to bring in more smart grid capability? Those are the kind of things that are going to be discussed in this next year. And if we don't change the leadership, we're not going to change the discussion, and we're not going to change the direction.
Yes, well, Steve, I want to thank you for coming on the Kudzu Vine tonight, and we wish you best of luck in your campaign, and maybe as the campaign progresses and things happen, you may join us again.
It'd be my pleasure. I thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, one quick comment on PSC races is when the Republicans took over started slowly to take over politics in Georgia, the first thing they did is they won seats on the PSC, and I would not be surprised to see if Georgia Democrats come back, is that the PSC is a place where we win a statewide seat or two. So obviously you have to have candidates in the race like Steve Oppenheimer to be able to do that. And so it's good to see Steve running and glad we could have him on the show. And simple, I want to thank both Steve's tremendous guests tonight. Of course, we did not get to talk about Keith Judd, and you know, a lot of people have talked about the fact that he got 40% of the vote in West Virginia. I wanted to explore his membership and then leaving the Federation of Superheroes. I think there's much more of a story there than anything else. I mean, why did he leave the Federation of Superheroes? And then why were the people of West Virginia willing to support him after he stopped being a superhero 30 years ago? That's the questions I have. How about you, Tim?
Yeah, really. I mean, what a guy, huh?
Yeah. I mean, he left. He was in there from 76 to 82. Maybe he was in there because of the Super Friends, and when they went off the air around that time, then he got disillusioned. I don't know. But those are the kind of questions I wanted to hit hard on, because we had too many serious good guests to get into that. Catherine.
Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah. See you tonight.
Good night, guys.
Night.